When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to distinguish the map from the territory and the model from reality. A chance to remember that no matter how complex they may get, our artificial intelligences are still artificial. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here. It's just us today. These little monologues may be my favorite episodes of the show. And from the data about how many people are listening, they may be yours too. They're not necessarily easier to do, but they feel somehow more intimate. These and the call-in shows we've been experimenting with, I'm thinking they do better because so many of our guests are on a bunch of different podcasts that platforming them here may not feel as special as just doing our own thing when we actually have the time to be together. Or when we do have guests, have someone who's not anywhere else and really interesting to find out about. I'm not sure yet, but I'm thinking a change in how we do things may be in the works. As always, you can support the show by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support, or going to rushkoff.substack.com, or just listen, which is totally fine. Skip the ads if you want. I'm hoping someone lets me read one soon, but till then, it's the same ads you're hearing anywhere else. Still, it's nice that they're willing to help support the show. Anyway, here's what I want to share with you today. Boy, these are challenging times on so many different levels, both microcosmic and macrocosmic. I'm in it with y'all, I promise. People have been asking for a monologue show for a while, and you'd think monologue shows are easier to do than the discussion ones, because I can just sit here and do it. But it kind of takes a while sometimes to have an idea I feel is worthy to bring to you. So while on the one hand, I'm trying to surface more ideas and be with you like this, on the other, I want to do it when I've got something. And I think I have something now. It's a half-baked something, but sometimes half-baked somethings are the best somethings to bring rather than shrink-wrapped ideas that are no longer open to engagement and discussion. So I was actually doing a talk 2 weeks ago at a conference that Jamie Cohn, who's been a guest here, that he was running. It was called From the Movement to the Moment, Tactical Media in Real Time. And the idea of the talk itself was some stuff that I think I've shared some of it before, but it was actually during the talk, while I was up there looking into people's eyes and saying the things I was saying, that I got the idea to think about and share something else with you. So let me share where I was at. This was a talk arguing that movement politics needs to give way to moment politics, that movement politics is 20th century style politics, where your movement has a real narrative to it. We're going to hold hands, keep our eyes on the prize, march up the hill together in a perhaps ends justifies the means journey toward the thing that we know will make things better. It's all based on really Aristotle's analysis of plays back a couple of thousand years ago in the Poetics. What Aristotle realized was that we have this narrative engine that shows up in all these tragedies and has become the narrative engine for really for Western civilization, that you create a character the audience likes, that character has a goal and makes a series of decisions that rise the tension, the stakes of the action until the audience can't take it anymore. And then the character finds a solution, or the gods come down and provide a solution, or there's this reversal and recognition and a climax, and then relaxation and relief, catharsis. It's a crisis, climax, sleep, structure of narrative, the sort of the male orgasm curve of narrative tension. And it's what we saw really in all of our television, all of our advertisements, but it was also what characterized most of our social movements, whether it was communism or capitalism, that you go and you go through this difficult period until you finally get to that place, that utopian vision that we all have for the future. And this way of movement making was really consonant with television. That's why it worked so well through the 20th century, through the invention of electronic media, whether it was radio or television. Radio was great for a leader, whether it was Hitler or Mao or FDR, to tell a story to the people about what it is we're striving for, where it is we want to go. These were very unifying media. The biases, as McLuhan would put it, the biases of television really were the illusion, the story that TV tells, and this globalism, this breaking down of boundaries. Television really brought us all into the same moment at once, into the same story, whether we were watching the moon landing or the Olympics or the last episode of MASH or Rhoda. They felt like these global events that were happening simultaneously, both good and bad. You know, the good of globalism would be Ronald Reagan at the height of the television era saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, right? Biden was just talking about that moment, but that was kind of the peak of somewhat enlightened globalism, that we're all on the same planet together. The environmental movement, the picture of the Earth from space. And the bad side of globalism, well, that was kind of global markets and global capitalism and these transnational corporations and the inability to have laws and legal structures to stop these things. The WTO protests, which were sort of in my earlier era, my first kind of activist period of my life, the WTO protests in Seattle were against this kind of global, totalizing economic force. It was hard to even name it, except to call it Davos or the World Trade Organization or the World Economic Forum. It was this abstracted global thing. And I remember no one understood what we were even doing, but that's another story. And in the 21st century, the narrative structure of the 20th century and before began to break down. Our always-on media, our remote controls, our joysticks, our computer mouse and keyboard and the internet and back-and-forth media and viral media, it broke down narrative. Kids were no longer watching television for the story. We were starting to get shows like Beavis and Butthead or The Simpsons, where the narrative of the story was less important than the moment-to-moment connections we made between scenes that we were watching and references to other places in media. I'll never forget there is a scene where Homer Simpson has to pick up Maggie from a nursery, a daycare center, and all the kids are sitting, they're spread out like the birds in Alfred Hitchcock's movie, The Birds. And you have this moment where you think, am I the only one who gets that satire moment? You get the release of making a connection rather than the release at the end of the story for Homer Simpson getting out of the nuclear power plant before it blows up or not, right? We don't care about the final end of the story so much in this style of narrative. We care about each little moment. And that was positive in some ways. It helped us break down and deconstruct the big narrative story that was being used to commandeer public opinion or get us to buy stuff. But it also disoriented us a little bit. And then once the internet went from being this place that you logged onto, I mean, the beautiful old internet where you plugged your computer into a modem and dialed up into the service and then downloaded the bulletin board conversation, then disconnected from the internet, read the whole conversation offline, spent maybe an hour or 2 hours crafting a one paragraph response, then logging back in and uploading your paragraph and waiting a few days to see how people responded. This kind of chess by mail pace of the early internet, this internet where because you used so much time to compose what you were going to say, you actually sounded smarter on the internet than you did in real life. I remember when you would meet someone in real life who you'd been talking to online, you were always concerned that they'd be disappointed because you could never sound as smart. Imagine that, right? The internet was a place where people sounded smarter and more considered than they did in real life. But then we took the internet and we strapped it onto our bodies as a smartphone, and we end up in this state that I've been calling present shock, where we are living in a state of perpetual emergency interruption, you know, the kind of state of media consciousness that used to only be endured by a 911 operator, but only for a few hours at a time, and they took medications for it. We're being bombarded all the time, and we end up, because we no longer have the solidity of 20th century stories of continuous linear narratives with beginnings, middles, and ends, because we're in a state of look at this, look at that, look at this, look at that, we end up trying to assemble all this stuff back together. We kind of create this Puntalist map of this must be connected to that. You know, the HAARP station in Alaska must be connected to the Davos meeting, must be connected to the earthquakes that there just were in Japan. You know, we end up in this kind of conspiratorial mess of making connections between things that aren't actually connected anymore. But the beauty of it, still, through all the disorientation, I still felt through much of it that we could liberated from the traditional narratives, from 20th century movements. We could now learn to create change without narrative. I mean, what would that look like? How might that work?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So while all the liberals were retreating to the narrative simplicity of a fictional television show like The West Wing. And the Tea Partiers, or the proto-MAGAs, were running to reality TV and the early humiliation of The Apprentice and those sorts of shows. Some of us were moving toward something else, more embodied by the WTO protests or Occupy Wall Street, where these were movements, if you will, but they weren't movements with clear goals. They were more pointing the way towards new normative states, toward new real-time ways of being. I remember at the WTO protests, and even a few years later at the Occupy Wall Street protests, CNN and the rest of mainstream media dismissed these movements because they didn't have clear narratives. At the WTO protests, there were labor activists, environmental activists, Palestinian activists, feminists. There were all these different kinds of groups there. And I remember CNN was there and they said, look, this is so confused. They don't know what they want. Right? Is this environmental or is this labor? It's like, no, we all had the common understanding that global capitalism, the way it was being practiced, was working against all of us. This is called solidarity, not confusion. Same with Occupy. The mainstream media didn't understand it because the occupiers wouldn't come up with a list of demands. What do you want to leave this park? It was like, no, it's not about that. It was about something else. Partly, it was about leaving one style of movement-based activism away from this ends justifies the means activism toward activism as a normative state. And the way I understood it from really the early internet stage, and it was when I was talking about this, actually. This is when I got the idea for what I want to share now. In the early internet moment, I remember I was saying, this is not a revolution. This is a renaissance. It's not a revolution where you use the same system and just replace the people at the top with our people instead of their people and end up in a circle. No, it's something much more complex. It's a renaissance where you rebirth old ideas in a new context. I thought that the internet would help engender this more complex, less Aristotelian way of doing change. The simple narratives of the 21st century are all about what is it you want, how will you get there, and then kind of getting to this happy ending place, as if the movement can end, as if we reach utopia. It happened. We're there. We won. We won the revolution. Whereas the more mature way of understanding the world seemed much more complex to me, much less revolution and more renaissance, less about watching some spectacle, right? The 20th century was about big spectacles and movies, and the technology-enhanced, sort of internet-enhanced 21st century would be more about interactivity and civic participation. So instead of watching a revolution on TV, we would participate in a renaissance on our keyboards, right? On our computers. But there was also a larger renaissance going on, this computer revolution, the digital revolution, the digital renaissance, as I put it. It augured a new embrace of complexity sciences over the reductionist ones and all the oversimplification that comes with them. Until computers, math and modeling was always really reductive. If you wanted to understand the volume of a cloud, you would model it as a sphere or an oval or, you know, some kind of a collection of spheres. If you wanted to measure the coastline of an island, you would treat the island as a polygon and look at the kind of lines that sort of approximate the boundaries of the island and add them up. So the mathematics of the time, and even in calculus, which, you know, it looks complicated, but calculus also, it's all about averaging and simplifying, trying to get the real world, which is sloppy and messy and confusing and complex, trying to get it to conform to these much more Euclidean or Platonic ideals, right? That's a line. That's a circle. That's basically an octagon, right? So you simplify, you smooth the roughness of reality in order to understand it. And that's how you get all the oversimplifications that work for the industrial age and capitalism. Let's grow corn in that field. Let's grow wheat in that field. Let's move all the cows over there. You know, and you get these monocultures and oversimplifications. And when you don't understand the systems, everything gets really screwed up. But this guy, Benoit Mandelbrot, he was working at IBM, and he was actually just looking for ways of predicting the patterns in interference on telephone lines. And he came up with this other idea, which was to use nonlinear equations to understand things. And nonlinear equations, it sounds complicated, but really it's just feedback loops. The feedback loops of computers, that's what computers are. They're cycles, they're feedback loops. Feedback is like when you take a microphone and put it in the speaker and you get that screech sound because it's picking up the noise and feeding it back into itself again and again and again. But in math, a feedback loop is where you take the answer to one equation and plug it back in as the new variable in the next one. So if you had, sounds complicated, but it's not. If you had a simple math equation, x plus 1 equals y. So if x equals 1, then it's 1 plus 1 equals y, so y equals 2. But once you have that y equals 2, they take that and plug it back into the equation as the new x. So now y is 2, so x plus 1, if x plus 1 or 2 plus 1 equals 3. So now 3 is the new y, and you take y and you make it the new x. So 3 plus 1 is 4, and 4 plus 1 is 5, 5 plus, and you know where that one's going, right? That's going to go up a nice straight line. Or if you could have like 2x plus 1 equals y. So 2 times 1 is 2 plus 1 is 3. And then you have the answer is 3 and plug that in. 2 times 3 plus 1 is 7, and so on and so on. And these equations, these feedback loops is how we got fractals. You've seen fractals, those giant paisley-like designs or generated graphs of stuff, and they end up looking really like nature. These complex linear or complex nonlinear equations, when you feedback, and keep looping them in a computer and ask the computer to graph this thing, you get these beautiful strange patterns, these super complex things that look like fern plants or forests or galaxies or coral reefs. They looked just like them, and they were infinitely complex and self-similar. You could zoom all the way into one little part of one of these pictures and you'd see new worlds that were similar but not exactly to the ones at higher levels. Or you could go out to bigger and bigger levels and see similar kinds of patterns. And the thing is, these things looked so much like nature. A lot of us were saying, oh, we've cracked the code. This is it. And we're going to live in a different kind of society now. The society we just lived in understood the ocean as a series of latitude and longitude lines. That was great for colonialists who want to map the world and then own each little box, right? The ocean is you're at this spot in the ocean, 33 degrees north this and 66 degrees west that, and that's the point that you're in. But if you're actually in the ocean, those longitude and latitude lines don't matter. Now you're looking at the water, at the waves, at the patterns. What the nonlinear equations did, what these fractals did, was showed us the sense in those patterns, in the waves. And it felt like, oh, good, we're going to get away from this reductive math of straight lines, understanding the ocean as straight lines. And now we're going to understand the ocean as these wave systems, these complex systems. And we started to use systems math for everything, to model the weather or populations or the stock market, where that's what stochastics is. Or even we looked at the net as this kind of giant fractal, this model of a collective human nervous system that the internet will allow us to become Gaia, this great self-similar fractal of human minds all connected together. But we kept forgetting. I really think we forgot that these are still models. They're just another map, a better map, a much better map, a more complex map, but still just another map, a fractal map. The fractal is not a fern plant. It just looks a whole lot like a fern plant. The fractal is not the stock market or the weather. It's just got really similar shapes. It provides insights. It's really cool, and you can zoom in on it, and it's really granular, but it's not reality. It's another map. It's just not a map going to these oversimplified Euclidean forms. And the maps produce answers, I mean, beautiful answers, new ways of farming, of building cities, of running societies, but they are still abstracted and disconnected from reality. It's like a game of SimCity is a more detailed map allowing for emergent phenomenon than a game of Monopoly, but it's still just a model. It looks more like reality, but it's not reality. It's just built on nonlinear equations, which are really built on regular old math. So now you throw in AI, and we think we're creating life itself. You know, it's even more convincing on some level than a fractal, because it can use all that kind of systems logic and fractal stuff, but then talk. But it's not really reality. It's just rhetoric. It's compositional techniques. That's what they are, large language models. These are compositional techniques for rhetoric. We think we're creating life. Well, some people do, but we're really just creating another layer of abstraction, a way of mining all the rhetoric that we've put out there and then synthesizing it into forms that simulate language without even using any logic or thought. In an AI, there's genuinely no one home. It's all model. It's all model, no reality, right? It's all model. It's looking at everything that we've modeled ever. It's looking at the history of all of our modeling, at least the modeling that we've digitized, and then developing language around those models, large language models. But there's really nothing happening there. It's all a form of auto-tuning, of taking what happened and putting it back together. But what the AIs might be able to do that we can't is distinguish between the maps and the territory. Why? Because AIs, they have access to all the maps. The real and best purpose of AI in our current civilization may be to serve as digital narcos, right? As informants for when something is a map, for when something is a social construction, for something that is not a given circumstance of nature. This is the problem that I've been talking about for a long time now, is we are walking around mistaking so many things for nature that are not, that are just models, that are social constructions, whether it's the money in our pocket or our form of government or who was a boss or the fact that we have to rent an apartment in order to live. I mean, all of these things that we accept as givens, I feel like the AIs can begin to help us recognize when something is not a given circumstance of nature, because they have access to all of the models. They are the latest and greatest version of modeling machines. The AIs can recognize that the central currency in your pocket is not value, but a particular form of money with a particular bias. The AIs can trace the origins of social artifacts that we now accept as givens, from employment and marriage to gender and markets. AIs can expose the gamification leading us to compete when we'd be better off collaborating. They can see the social constructions leading us to accept extractive and self-defeating approaches to work and life. And they can recognize the synthetic behaviors of all the other bots out there trying to fool us into adopting one destructive model or another. So maybe, just maybe, AI can become the next level of feedback loop, exposing the false promise of the totalizing systems of this digital age, whose higher levels of complexity still don't mean a thing to the living things attempting to flourish in harmony with one another along a myriad spectra of value exchanges we don't even know how to perceive or measure, much less model. None of that stuff is in the models because none of it's been recognized, none of it's been sensed, much less recorded. Our renaissance can't just be an affirmation of the last one's abstracted ideals at greater resolution or greater modeled complexity. It has to instead be a reclamation of the more experiential and ineffable qualities of real life. We can't fight over these human-created models and histories anymore. They're not real. They are all models. They are all games. They are rhetoric, simulations, approximations, theories. They are figures. They are never ground. And if you don't get what I'm getting at, I mean, it's partly my fault because I'm still expressing it in lots of ways rather than one simple way. But if you're not getting it, just sit there for a second and breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. That's really just it. Thanks for being on Team Human. It means a lot that you came. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.